latest episode of Nice Talks. I'm Georgina and I will be your host today. Today we are talking about ovarian cancer and how genetic testing could help to identify those most at risk and how to manage that risk following the recent publication of the NICE guideline called Ovarian Cancer, Identifying and Managing Familial and Genetic Risk. I'm joined today by Ranjit Manchanda, Professor of Gynecological Oncology at Queen Mary University of London and Barts Health NHS Trust, and a topic advisor on the NICE guideline, as well as Dr. Judith Hayward. Judith is a GP with special interest in genetics and also a committee member. I'm also delighted to welcome Mrs. Joanne Stanford, who is here to talk about her experience and is also a committee member. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining me today. Ranjit, I'd like to start with you. Can you tell us a bit about the purpose of this guideline and why we need it?
Thank you, Georgina. Around 7,500 women are diagnosed with ovarian cancer annually, and around 20% or 1 in 5 of these are caused by high-risk genes. People may not know that they are at higher risk and carry one of the an alteration in one of these high-risk genes, which puts them at an increased risk of ovarian cancer. Best estimates suggest that only 3% of people know they have a high-risk gene. So the guideline is really for people who are at increased risk of ovarian cancer, usually due to carrying an inheritable alteration called a pathogenic variant in one of these ovarian cancer genes. This may be women, men, trans and non-binary people who can carry a gene linked to ovarian cancer and can pass it on to their children. So it's not just for women and people born with female reproductive organs. The guideline aims to raise greater awareness and increase the availability of gene testing, allowing people to take preventive measures such as surgery. This would mean that fewer people will go on to develop ovarian cancer.
Joe, can you describe your experience to us as a patient and tell us a bit about when you first became aware of your genetic risk?
Sure. So I think my experience was quite typical of a lot of people I've spoken to since I found out about all of this. But it all started when my mum was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and she was around about 53. And I think like a lot of people at that point, we didn't know anything about the kind of the genetics related to this. And we were only really knew about her immediate family history. So we knew that her mum had died of breast cancer very young, at the age of 41. So my mum was only 18 and she had to help look after her younger siblings. So that had always been something we were aware of, but we didn't really know much further in our family tree. And I think that's quite common, really. So we were really lucky because this was this is 2005 when her GP luckily was really on the ball and said, oh, hold on a minute, you've got ovarian cancer. Your mum had breast cancer. Maybe you should speak to a genetic counsellor and look into this a bit more. And that's when she went off and did all those actually really tricky conversations with her family, particularly with her dad, who'd already lost his wife. And essentially, she kind of drew out her family tree and found out that ovarian and breast cancer was a lot more widespread throughout her family tree than she'd ever known. And I feel really lucky, actually, that that GP raised that with her at the time. That started the process then of her going through genetic counselling, and I went along with her to those sessions. And she was quite poorly at this point, so she was really doing this for us. It wasn't going to change anything for her. And essentially, I think I particularly remember the genetic counsellor looking at our family tree and saying, I don't even really need to put this through the risk assessment programme we normally use. It's very obvious there's something going on here, and offered my mum to do a blood test. My mum actually passed away before we had the results back, because back then it took quite a long time. And we found out that she did indeed carry a faulty BRCA1 gene. And I was then offered the opportunity to be tested myself. And I was very young at this point. I was 21, 22 when my mum died. And initially I kind of went full throttle into it. So absolutely, I want to know straight away. And I actually changed my mind a little bit after that and took a bit of time to think about it. Really, I feel really lucky that back then the GP kind of raised it when he did. And I've since gone on to have genetic testing, I've gone on to have risk reducing mastectomy, and I've also had my ovaries removed when I was 36 to reduce my risk of ovarian cancer. And that's all down to having these conversations, having the opportunity to learn about my risk.
Judith, I'd like to come to you now. Can anyone carry one of these genetic variants associated with ovarian cancer? And are there groups that are more at risk?
Yes, anyone can carry one of these gene variants, and current data tells us that about 3% of the population do carry one of these gene variants. However, people are more likely to carry one of these gene variants if they are at a particular at-risk group. One of those at-risk groups are people who have a significant family history, so people who have family members who are affected with ovarian cancer. And the guideline really clearly outlines the family histories that may flag an increased risk of carrying one of these gene variants. So a family history where there's one person affected with ovarian cancer, whether it's a first or second degree relative, and whether it's on the mother's or the father's side of the family history. And that's quite crucial because sometimes people can ignore a family history that's on the father's side. There are other groups who may not realise that they have that they are at risk because of a family history. And those would include men, as I've already highlighted, and also trans men and non-binary populations. So people who don't identify as a woman, however, they do have female reproductive organs, or even if they don't have female reproductive organs, they still have a chance of transmitting any gene change or gene alteration that may be running in the family. There are other groups who have a higher chance of carrying one of these gene variants or a gene variant in one of these genes because they come from a particular ethnic background. And those would include certain Jewish populations, Jewish Ashkenazi and Sephardi Jewish populations, and also those who have Greenlander ancestry too. So these groups are highlighted in the guideline as having a higher chance than those in the general population of potentially carrying one of these gene variants.
Ranjit, let me come back to you. Judith was just talking about high-risk groups. Are there any outreach programs for these groups?
Yes, Judith did mention that certain ethnicities or communities may be at a higher chance of carrying a variant or an alteration in, for example, the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. The most well-known probably is the Jewish community, where Ashkenazi and Sephardi Jewish individuals have a higher chance of carrying a BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene. Also, another prominent example would be those from Greenlander family backgrounds who have an increased risk of carrying a BRCA pathogenic variant. The NHS has recently launched a national Jewish BRCA testing program to identify individuals within the community who would be at risk and carry a BRCA gene variant, so that they can access options of screening and prevention to reduce their risk of getting cancer. And this is now available through self-registration through a website. The aim is to identify a large number of people who may not be aware that they're at increased risk, so that they can be offered options of screening and prevention. And this will lead go on to saving lives in the future.
And can you go into a bit more detail about what the guideline recommends for those who are at higher risk?
The most effective intervention for reducing risk without doubt is preventive surgery. And this ideally involves the removal of the fallopian tubes and the ovaries. This is usually feasible through keyhole surgery. The guideline provides recommendations on the ages of when surgery should be offered. And this is recommended from the age of 35 or 40 or 45, depending on the type of genetic variant that a person may carry. So it provides personalized risk management options for individuals who carry one of these gene variants. This is usually undertaken after the family is complete. This should be associated with informed counseling by a concerned specialist. And the guideline also provides guidance on the management structure for supporting the care of these individuals.
Joanne, I'd like to come back to you, please. Ranjit just talked a little bit about genetic counselling. Could you describe to us your experience of genetic counselling and how that works to help make decisions around risk management?
Sure. So I think for me personally, I was able to sit with my mum as she had her genetic counselling. So I almost was lucky in that I got a bit extra because I went into my own genetic counselling with a bit more background. And one thing I would say is, I think for people who haven't been through this before, although it's called genetic counselling, it's not what a layperson would describe as counselling. It's more about understanding options, decision making, really helping to understand how this affects you and your risk and your decisions going forward. So for me personally, that was about breast cancer risk and then ovarian cancer risk in the future.
And Judith, could you talk us through what would happen if someone came to your surgery and had a familial link to someone with ovarian cancer and were concerned?
That's a really important question. It's important that people understand what may happen and what may be asked when they do seek advice from primary care around a concern for their family history. So if they came in to me, first of all, they may see me or they may see one of my other healthcare professional colleagues. But if they came in to see me, the first thing I would want to ask them about is whether they had any symptoms that could suggest a new presentation of ovarian cancer. It's much more crucial and much more important to deal with any symptoms and investigate those first prior to thinking about family history and whether there could be a gene variant running in the family. And this guideline does already link to existing NICE guidance around when to recognise and suspect a diagnosis of ovarian cancer. So that would be the first thing to say. I would then want to elicit a little bit more about why somebody was concerned, what particular questions they had, and I would want to go through the family history. NICE also links into the familial breast cancer guidelines. This is important if there is a family history of breast cancer, and that would be the guideline that would be used in that instance. However, if there is no family history of breast cancer, then this new NICE guideline really addresses a gap that we've had for a while. We haven't had clear referral criteria around a family history of ovarian cancer, so it's really important that this guideline has been published and released.
And are there any tools that clinicians can use for assessing patients' risk?
So in primary care, the main tool is going to be this guideline, and NICE has very helpfully developed some summary infographics, including the referral pathway and the referral criteria, and I think that's going to be the most important tool for primary care. In primary care, we know that people tend to like information that they can use at the point of care, so when the patient is in front of them, that's really concise, really clear at a glance, because then it's very usable within a consultation. So as I said, I think it's really important that NICE have developed this infographic which takes us through the referral criteria.
Jo, I'd like to come back to you again. What would you say to anyone who thinks they may be at risk and is perhaps nervous about discussing this with a healthcare professional?
What I would say to somebody in that situation is to really use the resources that you've got. There's some amazing expertise out there along the way. There are charities and groups that you can speak to kind of more informally, but also, you know, when you get to that point of speaking to the genetic counsellor, ask all the questions you can, really take that opportunity to find out as much as you can. But what I would also say is, I think the narrative that we will often hear about people going through this is, you know, words like brave and, you know, knowledge is power and taking control. And while that's all very true, it can also be quite a lonely experience. It's a massive opportunity and I'm so grateful that we have it. But I think to really think about the fact that this isn't an answer in itself, it's the start of another journey, and it opens up a lot of questions. It opens up a lot of choices that you might think that you know exactly what you're going to do, and then when you're faced with the reality of it, it's a lot bigger. So what I would say is, you know, ask all the questions you can, speak to people in this situation who've been through this themselves, but make sure you surround yourself with as much support as you can get so that you don't feel lonely, so that you don't feel out of control, and to just really appreciate that you're going to need that help. You're going to need that support at multiple points along the way in your life. So don't be ashamed of reaching out and getting it.
And Jo, before we finish, is there anything else that you would like to add?
I think one of the things that I'd like to mention about the guideline and the process of creating in general is, I did say this to the committee at the time, but you know, NICE were absolutely fantastic of making sure that myself and Fiona, the other lay member, were heard and treated as experts in our own right with our experiences, and every member on the committee were really respectful of that. And I have to say that the process was fabulous in that respect, and actually the people involved were all so passionate about making sure that the patient experience is a good one, that a lot of the time the points I was going to make as a patient were already brought up by people such as Ranjit and Judith.
And finally, the same to you, Ranjit, do you have any final comments?
I echo what Jo has said. You know, we're there for our patients, and I do hugely value the patient experience. And I'm really, really delighted at the guideline.
We've come to the end of today's NICE Talks. A huge thank you to my guests, Professor Ranjit Manchanda, Joanne Stanford, and Dr. Judith Hayward. And thank you for listening. Please like and subscribe. And to keep up to date on all things NICE, follow us on social. @NICECOMS. Until next time.